Gamer Radio line, Grace.
And I'm Rob.
Well, that's a switch. All right, how about I'll be Rama today and you can be Grace? What the hell, huh?
No, I want to be Rama.
Okay, Rama. So, welcome to GER Radio anyway. If you want to get hold of us, I'm going to go through this really fast, so pay attention, folks. We have a couple of really good guests on today. Starting off on this hour, we have Brad Friedman from the Brad Blog, bradblog.com. And this is a really amazing story that he's going to be telling us about. And also coming up at the top of the next hour, we'll have Bob Fatrakis from Ohio. That's the Columbus Free Press. And
I'm glad he was able to make it back on the program.
Yes, absolutely. It's great to have him back again as a, you know, to fill us in what's been going on in Ohio. So let me get through the introductions real quick here. Contact information is a whole myriad ways of doing it. Head over to the website, GERradio.com. That's GRRradio.com. You'll see our email, live@gerradio.com, as well as our contact information for Microsoft and AOL Instant Messengers. Phone calls, 802-433-6114. Remember, that's GER Radio, GRR Radio. And, of course, the chat room. You'll see a link for the chat room, so you want to click right into that. And with that said, let's just head right on over to the phone. Hello, Mr. Friedman.
Yes, sir. Hello, Rama. How are you, sir?
I'm doing fine. Grace, you want to introduce yourself?
Well, sure.
Hold on a minute. Put your headphones on. Okay, Brad's on the phone. This is Grace.
So. Hi, Brad. Nice of you to join us.
Thank you. Is Grace, you said?
Yes, Grace.
Hi, Grace. How are you?
She's the better half of this duo here.
I got you. Okay.
By any stretch of the imagination. Okay, why don't you introduce yourself as you want people to know you?
Well, I'm the writer and the editor of bradblog.com. I've been investigating some interesting stories, some of them related to the election irregularities in this past presidential election. Really since the early morning hours of November 3rd.
Yeah.
I think you touched base with me in regards to a bit of breaking news on one of the stories that I've been reporting on a software programmer named Clint Curtis down in Florida who alleges that he was asked by a powerful Republican by the name of Tom Feeney to create a vote-rigging software prototype when he was working at a software firm named Yang Enterprises, Inc.
Now, Tom Feeney is a state senator, a Republican state senator in Florida, right?
Well, he was at the time, and not just a state senator. He was actually the Speaker of the Florida House.
Whoa.
Eventually. A very powerful man, and he's perhaps most famous for being the one during the 2000 election debacle to have said that he didn't care how the Supreme Court ruled on Bush v. Gore. He was going to see to it that Florida awarded its electors to Bush no matter what they had to say.
And it worked.
And it, he didn't need to because the Supreme Court went ahead and did him the favor, so he didn't have to worry about that. Now, he was also, it should be noted, the former running mate with Jeb Bush when Jeb originally ran for Florida governor in 94.
Now, in Florida, because not all states do this, they kind of run as a team for governor or lieutenant governor.
That's my understanding, yes.
Okay.
So he was lieutenant, he would have been on the lieutenant governor team with Jeb back in 94. They ended up losing. Feeney ended up in the Florida Senate and eventually ascended to the speaker position there. Time magazine, I believe, called him the most powerful man in Florida a few years ago, to Jeb Bush.
Brad, because this is really, this kind of involves a cast of characters. You've already mentioned Clint Curtis, who is the programmer and the whistleblower.
Yes.
This also involves a Yang Enterprises Incorporated, who
correct.
Tom Sweeney used to represent as a lawyer, or maybe still does?
Well, that's also a question, but he was there at the time of this meeting when Curtis claims that he was asked to build this software. Feeney was Yang's corporate counsel and their registered lobbyist, even while he was Speaker of the Florida House. He was the only, of I believe it's 160-member House, he was the only registered lobbyist.
And through Yang Enterprises, we also kind of get into, hiring illegals to work in the U.S., plus a little bit of Chinese espionage, as well as, most importantly, and I guess let's start with the very recent news on Raymond Lemmy, and then we can go back and kind of lead up to this, because it involves this guy, Raymond Lemmy, who used to work for the Florida Inspector General's office. First, am I pronouncing his name right? And second, am I correct on that?
You are correct on both. After there was some other incidents that were troubling to Mr. Curtis when he worked at Yang, which is, you're correct, the CEO is Mrs. Yang, and she is Chinese, as is her husband. They like to say they're Taiwanese.
Right.
But Curtis saw various elements of spying, espionage, and so forth going on while he was at Yang. I can go back and talk to that because many of those of the things that he alleged back in 2001 now have recently been very much confirmed by federal officials and arrests that have been made and so forth. So, jumping ahead just a bit, after he left Yang, he went to a new job at the Florida Department of Transportation, where Yang actually happened to have a contract that they either got because of their connection to Tom Feeney, or they got it all on their own. I'll let you decide. But once Curtis was at the FDOT,
right,
he noticed that there was billings coming in from Yang, that they were actually billing for his hours that he did not work at Yang. So he knew this, and he made a complaint to the Inspector General's office there, at the state of Florida. I guess there's an inspector general's office in each of the major departments. So there was an inspector general's office in the Florida Department of Transportation. He took his complaints to them about what Yang was doing specifically on their FDOT contracts. The inspector who was looking into it was Raymond Lemmy. Now, both Curtis and one other whistleblower at the FDOT had made these complaints, and both of them were summarily fired without explanation some months later.
Right.
Now, they also both won whistleblower cases against FDOT.
Okay, because we might start overlapping a bit and getting people confused now. They weren't fired. Clint Curtis,
yep,
worked for Yang Enterprises. He quit there under good terms, right? I mean,
that's correct. And though their attorneys have said that he was a disgruntled employee, in fact, when he put in his resignation, Mrs. Yang had asked him to stay on for a number of weeks until they could find a replacement. He agreed to do so. Stayed for, I think it was 6 more weeks, and then they threw him a big party at the end, gave him a farewell card, which even says is signed by all the employees, including Ms. Yang, and it says something like, the door will be open for you anytime in the future. So he left on good terms.
Okay, so we're talking to Brad Friedman of Bradblog, bradblog.com, coincidentally enough, and he's got a lot of really great information on there. In particular, we're talking about, the travails of Clint Curtis and the one-time Mr. Raymond Lemmy, who unfortunately has either committed suicide or been murdered, and that's really what nobody knows. But we're up to the point where Clint Curtis has quit Yang Enterprises. He's gone to work with the AOT. He found out that they were being billed by Yang Enterprises, which was a computer software company. The state was being billed for work they hadn't done. He did a whistleblower claim, and then Clint and another gentleman got fired from AOT.
Now, too, it was actually another lady. Was the
Oh, I'm sorry. All right.
That's all right. And it was FDOT, Florida Department of Transportation.
Right.
As they call it. So I know what you're asking about in regards to Raymond Lemmy. 2 years later, in 2003, mid-June 2003, Curtis claims in the sworn affidavit that he's given to me that Lemmy came to him and told him that the case was going very well and that Curtis should keep his ears open. Lemmy had tracked the corruption, quote, all the way to the top, and that he would be happy with the results to keep his ears open in the next couple of weeks. Well, 2 weeks later, Raymond Lemmy was found dead in a Valdosta, Georgia hotel room, having the police ruled it a suicide. In the police report, They say that there were pictures were taken of the crime scene. However, due to a failure in the camera's flash memory card, there would be no photographs from the crime scene.
Now, those are the photographs that you have posted on your website.
That's correct. They are now posted as of last week at bradblog.com.
Okay.
excuse me. It turns out they do exist, after all, and the Valdosta police have confirmed that those are, in fact, the photos from that particular case. They claim that once, I suppose I started reporting this back in December when I received Curtis's affidavit,
right.
That there was interest on the Internet, as they put it. So they reopened the case. Somehow they were able to get at the pictures that they hadn't been able to get at previously using special software. And then, as the public information officer told me, they spoke with someone at FDOT, and closed the case again shortly thereafter.
So, now, there are some problems, apparently, according to what you've been able to dig up. There's been some problems between the alleged, and I'm going to say alleged crime scene or alleged suicide scene,
right.
and what's been reported in the police reports. Can you go over that a little bit, Brad?
Indeed. There was there's quite a few inconsistencies and troubling items in the police report. Amongst them are some hotel receipts showing that Ray Lemmy seems to have checked in on June 29th, 2003. The problem is he didn't even leave his house in Tallahassee until the morning of June 30th, 2003. His wife testified in the police report that he kissed her goodbye at 5:15 a.m. that morning. Now, the police have explained to me very briefly that there was some problems with the hotel's timestamp machine on those receipts.
Okay.
But in my attempt to get more information from them, they promised to get back to me, promised they weren't stonewalling me, but needed to check the case. And then would, you know, call me the following Monday.
Right.
They did not call me. I called them, and I had called them pretty much every day for the next 2.5 or 3 weeks after that to try to get information, and they no longer returned calls.
So we've got the memory flash card that didn't hold the pictures that you posted on your website, and then
right.
we've also somehow got this timestamp machine at the hotel or the motel that wasn't working.
Correct. And there's a lot of other details in that police report that don't add up. One of the troubling things is now that we have the photographs from the crime scene, at least some of them, there may be more, I don't know, but this is what we have. And there are certain, you know, things that really jumped out at me when I was going through it that made no sense. For example, in the police report, it says that there is that he used a black leather belt, apparently as a tourniquet, that was lying next to the side of the tub. He killed himself in the tub.
Right.
No water in the tub. He was still in his clothes, but he was in the tub. There was a white towel laying next to the tub, and the belt was on top of the towel. In the police report, it says that dry blood was visible on the belt, but none was visible on the towel. Now, we have the pictures, and there's clearly blood all over the towel. Why that might be important, I don't yet know, except for the fact that it clearly shows that the police report says one thing that is very different from what the actual photographs of the scene actually show. So it makes you wonder what else was also amiss that doesn't match up with the police report.
Hmm. Do you have anything you want to add, Grace?
Well, could it just possibly be shoddy police work?
Very likely. And in fact, I had hoped, you know, I had sat on this story for about 3 weeks with the pictures available. I had sat on the story in an attempt to try to clear up some of these questions before I even reported it at all. It was only after getting that stonewall from the Valdosta police that I felt like I had to put the information out there. Sure, it could be very sloppy. I don't understand how anybody could look at, mind you, the person who wrote in her report that there was no blood on the towel is also the person who claims in the report that she took the pictures. So it's hard to look at that towel and not see the blood and then go home and write that. But yes, it could be sloppy. Unfortunately, that detective, Detective Shannon Floyd of Valdosta Police, no longer works at Valdosta Police. So when I had asked the public information officer there, Captain Brian Childress, where Ms. Floyd was, if I could speak to her to ask her some of these questions, I was told that she did not want to speak to me, that he spoke to her husband, and that she does not want to speak to me. She's no longer working at the department. She's teaching at a college somewhere, and he wouldn't tell me the name of the college. We've since found that due to the diligent work of bradblog.com readers, who frankly just used Google, it wasn't all that hard, but we were able to track her down to the to Valdosta Technical College, I believe is the name of it. I have made attempts still to get in touch with her, so far to no avail, but the fact that they wouldn't allow me to ask her some of these questions, and there are many, certainly doesn't make it look good. I'd like to believe it was just a case of sloppy police work and there's good explanations for all of these things, but if they're not going to talk about it, then I'm afraid they make it look a heck of a lot worse than perhaps maybe it is. I don't know.
We're talking to Brad Friedman, Bradblog, bradblog.com. It's actually a website chock full of a whole lot of things. I could actually talk to you and agree with you on things probably all night long here. But sticking with this Clint Curtis story, there was another thing that I understand and I find really interesting is the difference in autopsy laws between Florida and Georgia. Can you address that a little bit?
Right. Well, when I had first heard about this story and Clint had talked to me about some of these things, Clint Curtis, he explained the Lemmy story to me, and I asked him, well, what the heck was Ray Lemmy doing in Georgia if he lived in Tallahassee? Now, mind you, Valdosta is a sort of a border town. It's sort of the first big border town inside of Georgia, about 80-something miles away from Tallahassee. So I asked him, well, what the heck was he doing in Georgia, you think? And he said, well, in Georgia, there's no autopsy law. I asked him, what does that mean? He said, well, had he committed suicide in Florida, there would have been a mandatory autopsy. But because Georgia has no such law, if you commit suicide in Georgia, I guess they don't have to perform an autopsy.
Hmm.
Which, you know, particularly when one of the other huge things that jumps out at you when you look at these photographs, the police report has said that there was no signs of foul play and that the body, other than the two slashes on Lemmy's left arm with a razor blade, other than that, there was no sign of foul play or that anything had been amiss. However, the photographs show what seems to be a rather enormous bruise on the right side of Mr. Lemmy's neck. Now, if there was foul play and the photos weren't supposed to exist, maybe we would not have seen that, but we have seen that. Again, I'm not a crime scene specialist, so I'm sure other folks can jump in. In fact, they have. I think there's almost 600 comments on this particular thread right now.
I was going to say, I bet you got all sorts of crime scene experts that have been coming by your site by now.
We have all kinds of experts and not so experts, but everybody's got some thoughts. I guess everybody likes a good murder mystery, that's for sure.
Oh, boy, I'll tell you.
They have been all over this one.
Let me ask you, though, on this now. Was Lemmy's body cremated or was it just buried?
It was cremated.
I hadn't seen mention of that in your story, so I don't know if it was there or not, but somehow
you just had a feeling, huh?
It just seemed like the right answer there. Now, I know from a little bit, very little bit about suicides, but from what little I know, I had one friend who did kill herself some years ago, that women tend to try to be neat about it. They don't want to make a mess when they kill themselves, and they prefer not even to make themselves look ugly. They'll try to kill themselves in the least that does the least violence to their bodies possible. Have you looked into the aspects of what men do when they commit suicide? I mean, is it natural for Lemmy, for instance, to have crawled into an empty bathtub? He didn't do it for comfort. It seems like they're trying to say he did this to keep the mess down or something. Have you looked into suicide methods, and does that seem typical of a male suicide?
I have not spoken to any psychologist directly about this case, although I can say that by almost all accounts that I've gotten about Ray Lemmy, he was described as quite, well, I don't want to say fastidious, but detailed, detail-oriented, incredibly right. careful. As one person I recently spoke to at the FDOT said, you know, if you ask him, how is your day going, he wouldn't say, oh, fine, thanks. He would say, well, you know, considering the fact that I woke up at 4:30 this morning and then went out for yada yada. So it was very detail-oriented. So, in that sense, I think it would be a mistake, perhaps, and I've been trying to give the benefit of the doubt
right.
on all of this. So I think it would be a mistake to say, I had noticed somebody had mentioned in one of the comments that depressed people, don't bound out of bed at 5:15, which was like an hour earlier than he usually left for work. That's not really true.
No, and especially I've read about suicide people is they tend to feel good when they finally have made up their minds up to kill themselves. They actually get an uplifted feeling. They know that they're taking care of business finally.
That can happen, and there is and also people behave when they're in a state like that where they are willing to kill themselves. They're not necessarily in a particularly rational state, so.
Right.
All kinds of things and all kinds of behavior is possible. That said, there's some pretty, huge things that, one would question. For example, the note that was left there was not signed. It had the time on it, 8:10 a.m., but it didn't have the date on it, which certainly would have helped.
Yeah.
And in the note, it's one of these sort of generic suicide notes. I am unhappy. I can't take it anymore. I love my family. Goodbye. Something like that. I don't
right.
have it in front of me. But what he does mention is his wife by name, Marianne. However, his daughter, his only child, was to be married in two months later in September, and he doesn't mention her by name.
Now, that seems kind of weird. Yeah, just a couple of comments from the chat room right now. This Neil Constipated first, and I don't pick the names. These folks do, okay? But he says he worked in the funeral industry for 15 years and says slit wrists are usually women. Men, gunshots are hanging, but the woman I know who killed herself did it with a gun, so... take that for what it's worth. But Le Proletariat wants me to ask you if using digital cameras in these sort of investigations is typical of police practice. He says, wouldn't film be less questionable at court time?
I might have thought so. But again, I'm not a criminologist there. That's certainly something to look into.
Okay. All right. We're talking to Brad Friedman of the Brad Blog, bradblog.com. And this is a, if nothing else, this is good movie fodder. And I tend to be suspicious of the conspiracies on things like these myself. So we have now, Clint Curtis.
Yeah.
Started working with Yang Enterprises Incorporated. Now, they did actually get somebody convicted of espionage from Yang Enterprises, correct?
Yeah, as it turns out, Curtis had been, when he first made his report to FDOT, he had reported that there was a fellow by the name of Hai Lin Ni, who actually goes by Henry Ni, who had been working out of FDOT, out of Yang, on the FDOT contract. Now, it was believed, and we have several emails that would seem to confirm this, that Mike Cohen, who was Mrs. Yang, the CEO, was her executive secretary, believed that Henry Ni was an illegal alien at the time. And, of course, that would have been against the rules for the contract that Yang had with FDOT, not to mention the even more secure top-secret contracts that they had with NASA,
okay.
Which was another contract of theirs. Curtis, in his affidavit, claimed that Ni was putting wiretapping modules into software code that they were developing for NASA and FDOT. And
so he was putting in back doors so somebody could surreptitiously access an important computer.
Correct. That's what Curtis claims, that in the end they were downloading databases of stuff, and that Mrs. Yang was sticking it in an envelope and sending it to her brother in China, who Mrs. Yang had told Clint Curtis had been deported for spying some years before. Now, all of this was made, all of these claims were made by Curtis back in 2001, before anybody really understood or knew for sure what Mr. Ni's alien status was. As it turns out, years later, in 2004, after what was a four-year sting, the feds arrested Henry Ni on three counts of espionage for attempting to send Hellfire anti-tank missile chips to China. In the plea agreement, which was struck just two or three months later, Ni pleads guilty on one of the counts and says in that plea agreement that it had been a slow year, so they had only done this 10 or 20 times over the past year. Then, in October of 2004, Ni was sentenced for this espionage-related charge, and he was given 3 years probation and a $100 fine.
Wow, that's a rather severe sentence for espionage.
Yeah. Espionage.
For sending missile chips to China only 10 to 20 times in the past year.
Well,
so
now,
and it was also finally confirmed, in fact, that Ni had been an illegal alien since January 1 of 2000. So Curtis again was right on that count. He had reported that years before it was officially known, or that Ni had been arrested. So he was right about those claims. He's been right about I'd say 85 or 90% of the claims that he has made have been proven true over the years. There's a long paper trail on all of this stuff, and most recently, in fact, in February. The report that Ray Lemmy began back in 2001 was finally issued by the Florida Department of Transportation, and in fact they found that there was anywhere from $200,000 to $800,000 at least that was unaccounted for that the Yangs had charged FDOT for. So again, he was right there. Oh, and I should add that even to this day, the Yangs, Mrs. Yang and the company still claim that Henry Ni didn't work for them, despite the fact that it says so in the report, and despite the fact that I posted several weekly time reports that Yang had given to the FDOT, which were signed by Henry Ni, showing that he worked for the company on the FDOT contract anywhere from 40 to 60 hours per week.
Now, there seems to be nothing but questions get raised here, and then we come up with Tom Feeney, who's been acting as the representative, legal representation for Yang Enterprises, and we covered this before, too, but I just want to go over it again. Tom Feeney, according to Clint Curtis, in an assigned affidavit that he's given you, and I don't know if anybody else, he says that Tom Feeney asked Clint Curtis says Tom Feeney asked him to help write some software that would rig voting machines.
Yeah, and you know, just to fill in a bit of detail there, of course, I had the affidavit and posted it on bradblog.com, and it's still there for anybody to read, but he also gave it to members of the House Judiciary Committee who have met with him. He's also met with various senators up on Capitol Hill about this matter. It's a sworn affidavit, and in fact, he gave sworn testimony, which was videotaped, to members of the U.S. House Judiciary Committee. That video is also available online. This is public testimony that he gave on this matter under oath. So he hasn't hidden from anybody on this. He's answered, you know, all questions that have come about, everybody who's wanted to interview him about it. He's been on the radio and so forth, and you know, has talked to any reporter who cares to know. On the other hand, Mr. Feeney and the Yangs and their attorneys have been quite circumspect about the whole thing. They don't care to answer much about it other than to Well, first say Clint Curtis is a disgruntled employee, which they don't say anymore since we posted the farewell card that was given to him.
Right.
But now they just sort of call him a liar and refuse to talk about it. Mind you, Tom Feeney has now ascended to the United States House of Representatives, where he sits on the U.S. House Judiciary Committee.
Well, that's where criminals go to serve their time, isn't it?
Well, that could very well be the case, yes.
Now, a
question, getting back to Ray Lemmy.
Yeah.
Has anybody spoken with, had an interview with his wife or daughter, and what is their feelings about this?
I have spoken with members of their family, members of the family on background. I promised, you know, that I wouldn't go into who exactly I was speaking to and specifics of what they had to say. But the best understanding that I have is that the wife does believe it was suicide, though they were all, the entire family was completely shocked by this happening, didn't expect that it would happen. It sort of came out of the blue. He had just spent a time with the reserve, a weekend with the reserve. He had been given an award recently by the Inspector General's office. So he did, in fact, catch everybody by surprise. But as of now, anyway, my understanding is that the wife believes that it was suicide. Other family members seem to express some concern, and some of the questions that I've discussed, they don't seem quite as clear.
Well, first off, we're talking to Brad Friedman of Brad Blog. That's bradblog.com up on the internet. I mean, it seems like you've really covered a lot of this in detail on your blog. You've done some really great investigative reporting on this, as far as I'm concerned, Brad.
Thank you, Bob.
Is there any further for it to go, or are there any more crime scenes? Are there more allegations that haven't been talked about? I would like to say in public, but I guess it's been in public, but minus the mainstream media.
Yes, minus the mainstream media, indeed. There are places for it to go, and there should be a few other developments coming in the next week or two that I can't yet go into detail on. I will say the key element, of course, at the heart of this now is these vote rigging charges, and in fact, that is really the only thing left in large part that hasn't been confirmed in some way, shape, or form. Now, that meeting took place in October of 2000. Curtis claims Feeney was there. Mrs. Yang, the CEO, was there, and her executive secretary, Mike Cohen, was there.
Right.
So he's placed all of these people in the room. Attempts to speak with Mike Cohen since the story broke have not gone well. He's hung up on me. He won't talk to me. And in fact, after the story was broken, his name and phone number at work was removed from the Yang website. And, in fact, he no longer works inside the main Yang headquarters. Now he works over at NASA for Yang. They have a contract still with NASA, and they sort of got Mike Cohen out of the way, so pretty much nobody can speak to him or ask him any questions about any of this. So I think there is more to go on this matter. I think, in fact, given the sentence, and this is just my opinion now, but given the sentence, the incredibly light sentence that Nee was given.
Right. What were they? They were going to ruin the entire life of that gentleman out in, I was going to say Aberdeen, I don't mean that.
Wenho Lee,
they were going to crucify him.
In New Mexico, yes.
Yeah. Right, and it turns out they didn't really have much on him, whereas this guy, they've got all kinds of things on him, and they let him walk, which, frankly, says to me that he must at this point have turned state's evidence or something, and that he's cooperating with the FBI is my best guess.
Well, maybe there's something to come out. Can we move on to just a couple short topics? I don't want to keep you too much longer. We need to stop and take a break ourselves, and but I want to ask him about the bloggers being a legitimate news source. Out in California, of course, there's that case that I think it got heard by a California state court, hasn't hit the federal court system yet, where a California court has said that internet bloggers do not get the same protection under law that more standard journalists do. On the other hand, the White House has allowed one blogger to go in now as in their press corps, and the Supreme Court ruled in 1997, I think, that the internet has the same free speech as you and I talking in person. Right. As we do, with all that coming together, I mean, obviously, like we just talked about this Clint Curtis case, you've spent a lot of time and effort and probably money on doing some really great investigative work. Where do you think the law is going to come down on this? Do you have any idea? And where do you think bloggers fit into news coverage?
You know, of course, all of this is just speculation on my part, but I can tell you what I hope. I hope that what happens is they take a look at the work that people are doing and determine if they are journalists based on the type of work that they're doing. That case in California involves Apple Computer attempting to get these three bloggers to reveal their sources. Apparently these guys had posted information about some upcoming product lines or something.
Yeah, it was with Apple, yeah.
And, it's a great concern. Because, I know for myself personally, I've had, sources on this case, on this Clint Curtis case, who probably wouldn't speak to me if they, felt that I would be forced to divulge their information. And frankly, given the sorts of things we're dealing with, and, Ray Lemmy, unfortunately, is not the only possible violence that has occurred related to this case, these folks would not want to speak to me if they knew it was going to be public, because their lives could well be in danger, given some of the stuff that we know. So,
sure.
I think it's important, for it doesn't really matter if you're a blogger, if you're running an internet-only news site, like rawstory.com, for example.
Yep.
You need to be able to protect your sources. And to say that, just because they're on the internet, that means they're not a journalist. Well, indeed, there are many bloggers out there who are doing, crap, pardon me.
Right.
But, reporting rumors and that sort of thing.
It is the internet, Brad.
What's that?
It is the internet,
Well, yeah. And, the plain fact is there's also people in the mainstream press doing exactly that. In fact, Judith Miller reported
yes.
in the New York Times for a year that there was, WMD in Iraq, and we ended up going to war because of that. So you really have to take a look at what these people are doing. Now, mind you, there, Judith Miller may go to jail herself because she refuses to give up sources in the Valerie Plame investigation, which, by the way, she didn't even report on, while the guy who did, Robert Novak, doesn't seem to be under any
criminal charges at all. That's rather odd. I know that.
Yeah. Of course, maybe they flipped Novak, though.
That's one of really the only explanations for it. He's
well-connected.
Yeah.
Hey, that's been known to happen, too.
It's troubling when journalists themselves may not even have those protections. Journalists, meaning, print journalists like
right.
the New York Times, they may not even have the protections to keep their sources private. So Lord only knows what's going to happen with bloggers.
Well, my understanding of the law is it's state laws that provide the protection. At the federal level, there is no blanket protection for journalists, and that generally they just don't chase after them unless they absolutely have to. I mean, that's just my understanding, but if you listen to me as a lawyer, you're going to jail. So
yeah, well, that's my problem, too, so I probably shouldn't comment either way. But I understand you're in general correct there, although there are some who argue that the First Amendment of the Constitution would allow
right.
to protect their sources.
Yeah, you'd think so. One other, I want to give you a big attaboy, and you deserve a lot big attaboy for the Clint Curtis story, among others. And this isn't the only story that you cover. You have a very active blog that really does some great investigative work on a handful of different stories that I've seen up there today. One big attaboy I got for you is your zero award that you gave to Senator Joseph Biden of Delaware. He's in the early running for the Weenie of the Year award from me. Yeah. For getting up and explaining how Condoleezza Rice lied to everybody about the weapons of mass destruction, but how it really wasn't a lie, so therefore he was going to vote to. When I heard that, I used to respect the guy. I didn't agree with him all the time, but I always felt that at least, because he seemed to be so honest and straight on, especially with what he said about Iraq. And then it just hit me. It was like, God, you wiener.
Yeah, you know, I got to agree with you. I mean, I had always found him to be a really straight shooter and one of the few Democrats, frankly, that I had much respect for left in the Senate. And, you know, I think what he did on the bankruptcy bill kind of pushed me over. But the week before that, he had been on Bill Maher's Real Time show complaining about how nobody was investigating the Gannon-Guckert scandal. And that, you know, that the House Judiciary Committee ought to be on it, the Senate Judiciary Committee ought to be on it, yada, yada. But the fact that, poor him, he was in the minority as a Democrat, so they weren't able to get any investigations going. Well, sure enough, 2 days later, Harry Reid circulated a letter calling for an investigation of Gannon, of the Gannon matter.
Right.
And Joe Biden didn't sign on to it.
There you go.
They were only able to get five or six senators. So, I don't understand that. And then, of course, this bankruptcy thing comes around, and,
A lot of money.
A lot of money, and he's from Delaware.
And Delaware is one of those big corporate states.
Credit card capital of the world. And, he voted in favor of the credit card companies instead of Americans. So, I got to say, if I had one Democrat in the Senate, I may not have any anymore.
Well, Brad, I want to thank you for your time.
It's been a pleasure, Rama. Thanks for having me on, and I'd love to do it anytime you need me.
Okay, absolutely
thank
enlightening. Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
You have a great evening.
You too.
I absolutely will.
All right, folks. That was Brad Friedman. You just have to push that button that hangs it up. There you go. That was Brad Friedman of the Brad Blog, bradblog.com. Talking about what really is one of the most twisted murder stories I've heard in a long time.
I've been enlightened.
Yeah, well, you saw some of the pictures.
And, yes.
At some other point when we have a little more time to stop and peruse them, you should take a look because you're into things like this.
Well, I'm actually like Anne Rule. I've read almost every one of her books.
Yeah.
And Anne Rule is a true crime writer.
And she's a great one, too, and rules. But all right, well, we're going to stop, take a quick little break here, and we'll be
right back.
I certainly appreciate all that you do in our community. You have a great voice in our newspapers and on the radio.